You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
I want to welcome everybody here today. This has been this partnership with Robbie Jones and PRI has been a great joy for us here at Brookings. I'm E.J. Dion. Our partnership is in our eighth year, and I am happy to say that polling partnerships are not term limited. So I hope that we can continue with this work. My colleague Bill Galston will formally welcome our friends Joy Reid and Henry Olson. They have been partners with us now for many years and always give the best analysis of Robbie's numbers and kick off a really good conversation. Just so you know how we're going to go, Robbie will do one of his patented PowerPoints where he will explain all these numbers to you very clearly. And then Bill will come up and introduce Henry and Joy. They're going to have a response to the poll. We're going to do some Q&A and crosstalk up here, and then we are going to bring you all into the conversation. Robbie, as many of you know, is the CEO of PRRI and a leading scholar and commentator on religion, culture, and politics. He is the author of many books, including The End of White Christian America, a fascinating book that came out last year, now out in paperback. If you have not seen it yet, you really should take a look at it. He writes a column for The Atlantic on politics and culture, appears regularly in a Faith by the Numbers segment on Interfaith Voices. He has been featured in just about every national media you can think of. He has got a PhD in religion from Emory University, where he specialized in the sociology of religion. He also holds an MDiv from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and, so you can trust his numbers, a bachelor's degree in mathematics and computing science from Mississippi College. He is the founder of PRRI, and he also was an assistant professor of religious studies at Missouri State University. But as those of you who have not experienced it before, he is one of the best PowerPoint artists in the country, and I wish I had those skills. It's a real joy to welcome our friend Robbie Jones. Thank you, Robbie.
Well, welcome, everyone. I am really pleased that to be here for the eighth year in a row. It has been quite a while, and I see a number of faces. Has anyone been here for all of them? I see a lot of actual familiar faces up here. Well, thank you for coming, and we also have a webcast audience who's joining us, so welcome to all of you who are joining us via live webcast. I just want to say, before I jump in, a big thanks to the PRRI team. These big surveys and reports are always a team effort, and I want to say a shout-out to my co-authors, Dan and Alex and Molly, and also for the rest of the PRRI team helping with editorial, logistical, and everything under the sun to get us here today, to Carolyn and Sheridan and to Ariel as well. So thanks to the PRRI team here. Well, let's jump in. So we're going to take a look out sort of 1 year in and 1 year out from the midterm. So looking back and looking ahead a little bit, like where are we? And I think focusing a lot on trying to understand what's going on, if anything unusual, with the Republican coalition under Trump 1 year in. So that you'll see a lot of different ways we'll be slicing and dicing the data, particularly looking at fissures inside the Republican Party, or no fissures, as the case is in some ways. But hopefully we'll come away with a better sense of where the country is on some major issues, and also in particular where the Republican coalition is at this point in time, as I said, looking back and looking ahead as well. If any of you are tweeting today, we do have a hashtag. It's AVS2017, so feel free to use that if you're tweeting along with us. Okay, so I'm going to start with job performance. There's been a lot of press out there about President Trump's historically low job performance. We are also finding it at historically low levels. Among all Americans, we're at 41% approve 22 percentage points of that is strongly approve, and then we are looking at about 6 and 10 disapprove, with 42% strongly disapproving in the general public here. If you look, not surprisingly, there are big partisan differences on this front. And, you know, one thing to say is that President Trump, among Republicans, self-identified Republicans, is doing quite well. So 84% overall saying they approve of his job performance, only 13% saying they disapprove. Independents look like the country as a whole, but there are Democrats, right? 72% strongly disapprove, not just disapprove, but strongly disapprove, with an additional 13% disapproving, only 12% approving of President Trump's job performance level. So quite a partisan split. So we're going to take a little bit of a different dive here. So here's the same numbers from before, 41% support, but looking at the gender divides on Trump job approval here. Men are basically divided on this, kind of men overall, this is in the entire country, about the same number approve and disapprove, but there is notably this big 49% block of women who not only disapprove but strongly disapprove of President Trump's job performance, only about a third of women approving of his job performance at this point in his presidency. So we tried to take also another way of looking at this, a kind of deeper dive, and we asked a follow-up question of everyone who said that they favored President Trump's job approval. We asked a follow-up question, said, okay, great, so you've told us you favor him. Is there anything he could do to lose your support, right? To kind of get a sense of just how tight the support was. And for those who said they did not approve, we asked the same question also, is there anything he could do to gain your support on the other side, to get a sense of just how dug in these opinions were. So this is kind of the typology here, strong supporter, those who favor and say there's virtually nothing President Trump could do to lose their support. And then all the way down on the other side, we're labeling strong opponents, those who oppose Trump or don't favor his job performance and say it's impossible, virtually impossible for him to gain their support. So here's what the lay of the land looks like. So basically, there's that 41% job approval, but when you break it down this way, there's 15% of the country who say they not only favor him, but there's virtually nothing he could do to lose their support. That's that 15-point anchor. And then all the way on the other side, what you can see is there's a pretty solid group in the country, 33%, who say they don't favor his performance. There's virtually nothing he could do to gain their support. So the people dug in on both sides is 2-1 on the opposition side, right, in terms of intensity here, which is notable, I think. So when we look at this and break it out, I'm going to do two slides here. So who are Trump's strongest supporters using that same scale about favorability and those who say there's nothing he could do to gain or lose his support? This is what it looks like. So these are Trump's strongest supporters here. Among Republicans, you can see there's that 84% approval rating, and about a third, 34%, saying there's nothing he could, virtually nothing he could do to lose their support. White evangelical Protestants, been a lot in the news here, especially with the Roy Moore candidacy down in Alabama, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later. But 72% approving of President Trump's job performance so far, but 3 in 10 saying there's virtually nothing he could do to lose their support. So about 3 in 10 really locked in. Whites with no college degree or white working class Americans, just barely over the 50% mark at 55%. Here, about a quarter of them saying there's nothing he could do, and there's white men at the bottom. But if I put the other side up, you can kind of see how it falls out. I do want to point out among white working class Americans here, this 24% on each end, right? So that's notable, I think, that this kind of next to the last column here, quarter say there's virtually approved and virtually nothing he could do to lose their support. On the other side, about a quarter saying they disapprove and there's virtually nothing he could do to gain their support. So this is kind of leaning a little bit more towards support, but there is this kind of intensity parity on either side. Here's the other side of this equation. So those who are Trump's strongest opponents, and you can sort of see here's the approved side among groups that are least likely to support him. And yes, that is a zero hiding behind the axis there among African Americans on that side. But among Democrats, like, you know, so it's 1 in 10, but only 2% saying they're really approving him at that level. But here's the real story. If you look at the other side, right? So this, all the green is disapproval, and the dark green are groups who not only disapprove, but say there's virtually nothing Trump could do to gain their support, right? So among African Americans, 6 in 10 African Americans not only disapprove, but say there's virtually nothing he could do to gain their support. So really locked in groups. Latinos, much more mixed than African Americans here. We'll see this in some other slides as well. But the other groups, religiously unaffiliated, strongly also, and women. About 4 in 10 women not only disapprove, but say there's virtually nothing he could do to gain their support. So that's just kind of the story on job approval. But let me kind of go through a few other political challenges here. And some of these are looking ahead. So right now and looking ahead. So this is a question we've asked three times across the year. Based on what you've read or heard, do you believe that President Donald Trump should be impeached and removed from office, or don't you feel that way? When we asked right after the election, it was about 3 in 10 who said in February who said they supported impeachment. That number jumped up to 4 in 10 in August the next time we've asked it, but it's remained steady since we asked it in August, and this has been fairly stable. But again, here you can see there's a fairly large gender gap, with men about 2 to 1 saying that they would oppose impeachment. And women evenly divided on the question, right? So there's a really big, you know, gender gap on this particular question. So looking ahead to 2018, one of the things we find here is a distinct Democratic advantage. It's not a landslide, but it is a 7-point Democratic advantage. And we ask people to anticipate how they would vote for either the Democratic candidate or the Republican candidate in their election district in the midterm elections. Again, here, fairly big gender gap going on here, 51-31, so it's a 20-point gap among female registered voters here, with basically half of them, more than half of them say they prefer the Democratic candidate, only about 3 in 10 saying that they prefer the Republican candidate in their district. 2020, so we look ahead to 2020, here's what we see, and this is looking at among Republicans here now saying whether they would prefer Trump to be the nominee or would prefer someone else. I do think it's notable that we basically have 3 in 10 Republicans saying they prefer another nominee in 2020 at this point in the presidency. It's 2 to 1 the other way, but there is 3 in 10. And if we look at kind of strong Republicans and weak Republicans, and these are people who kind of self-identify as a strong Republican or weak Republican, you can really see that really who Trump has more in his corner are people who are strong partisans, right? People who are strongly identify with the Republican Party. So it's not kind of outliers to the Republican Party, but strong people who strongly identify with the party. And among weak Republicans, there's actually a plurality the other way, wishing nearly half wishing there was a different candidate. Here are white evangelical Protestant Republicans, and you'll see there it's 7 in 10, squarely in President Trump's corner, only about a quarter saying they prefer a different candidate. And then this is kind of all other Republicans, so this is kind of a binary break. Those who are white evangelical Protestants and everyone else, essentially, 56% of non-white evangelical Republicans saying that they wish for Trump, and then 37% saying they wish for a different candidate. So to that question about who's still in his corner, clearly white evangelical Protestants still strongly in the president's corner. We also took a look at just perceptions of the party, and especially with the midterms coming up, what kind of party loyalty is it? And in particular, what this political science literature has suggested for a while now is that the story here is less about who loves their own party and more about who hates the other party, right? That's typically how it runs. So we try to get underneath this a little bit and get a sense of it. So we asked this question, a three-part question. Do you feel like the policies of the following group, and we gave people three options. Are they moving the country in the right direction? Are they somewhat misguided but not dangerous? Or are they so misguided that they pose a serious threat to the country? All right, so kind of giving people these three. And so what I'm going to show you is what Republicans think about Democrats and what Democrats think about Republicans here. All right, so I'm going to give you the first category first. Here are all the Republicans who think the Democrats are moving the country in the right direction and all the Democrats who think the Republicans are moving the country in the right direction. All right, that's it. Five. So you can see where this is going, I think. So here's the middle category, are somewhat misguided but not dangerous. All right. And here's the last category, so misguided they pose a fundamental threat to the country. So majority territory, almost mirror images of each other, pretty perfect negative partisanship in the country today. So I think taking this in kind of helps explain a lot when we're puzzling over particular candidates and the party, I think in particular. We can come back to that. But this is where we stand. There's a couple of other ways we can break this out that illuminates. We also asked this question not only about the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, but about President Trump's policies itself, so we could compare the Republican Party versus Trump, the Trump administration itself. And this one is among all Americans. So what's notable here is that among all Americans, the parties fare about equally well, right? If you just, and it kind of goes to the divided nature of the country. But if we look among all Americans just at President Trump, nearly half of the country, 46%, say that they see a distinct difference between the Republican Party and President Trump, and see Trump's policies as a particular danger to the country itself. However, if you look at Republicans, so this next slide I want to show you is the same data, but among Republicans, basically what they think about their own party and Trump, right? So this is among Republicans, what they think about their own party and Trump. And, you know, notably, about a majority of them say that that the Republican Party's policies are moving the country in the right direction. But about a third say they're misguided, and 7% say they pose a threat to the country. But here's what's notable in kind of to our bigger question about kind of Trump and the Republican Party, that more Republicans think that Trump is moving the country in the right direction than think the Republican Party is moving the country in the right direction, right? So, and it's notable, 67%, nearly two-thirds of Republicans say Trump's policies are moving the country in the right direction, 55% of Republicans. So that, I think, is also notable just in terms of where Trump's strengths are inside of self-identified Republicans on, you know, rank and file Republicans on the ground. Here is what Democrats think about Republicans and Trump as well. So 54%, that's the slide we saw a second ago. But here's the Democrats' impressions of President Trump, seeing a clear difference, about 20 points, more likely to say that President Trump's policies are misguided and pose a serious threat to the country. All right, so one more round on is the GOP the party of Trump here. We also took another look at this, kind of another swing at it, in looking at whether people supported Trump as their preferred primary candidate in 2016 and whether they wanted him to be the 2020 nominee again. And so using those two questions, we basically came up with people who he was both their preferred candidate in 2018 and 2016, and they like to see him at the ticket, top of the ticket in 2020. The exact opposite, on the other hand, that he was not their preferred candidate in 2016, nor do they want them to see him in 2020. And then the mixed groups who were with him but now say they'd like to see someone else, and then the people who were not with him but are now with him, right? So we kind of got people moving away here. And this is what the lay of the land looks like here. And this is among all Republicans and Republican-leaning independents. So we kind of group everyone who leans Republican and self-identified as a Republican for this analysis. But basically, you see this first point is 18% is basically labeled never Trump. Like he was not their preferred candidate in 2016. He's also not their there was someone else in 2020. Notably, this is where the predominant category where Mormon Republicans reside. Notably, so about 1 in 10, 11%. Of that category is made up of Mormons, which is a sizable number given the small size of Mormons in the country as a whole. So that's one thing to say about that category. The next category here is the leaning away from Trump. About 23% of the country is leaning away from Trump. The one thing I'll point out here is that this is the category that has the most non-white Republicans in it, right? So people who are African-American, Latino, or mixed race. And what this, you know, one thing that we can see from that is that these are people who he was their preferred candidate in 2016 and are now leaning away from him, saying he's not their candidate. So inside of this kind of Republican and leaning Republican group, one thing we could say is that disproportionately non-white Republicans are moving away from Trump based on these two questions. Then there's about similar number who weren't with him but are now leaning toward him, 19%. And then this 40% over here were with him before and are with him again. So that's kind of the lay of the land. To give you a sense of how this plays out on a couple of questions and to give you, I think, just a sense of the attitudinal differences among particularly the poll ends here. Here's a couple of Trump's signature issues. Temporarily preventing people from some majority Muslim countries from entering the U.S. That's in the news today. Building a wall along the U.S. border with Mexico. So these two numbers are where all Republicans and Republican-leaning independents are. So a little more than 6 in 10 support among all Republicans. But if we look at the Never Trump group, there's a little bit of fall off on the kind of Muslim travel ban number here, but a fairly big difference on the idea of building a wall with Mexico. Those in the Never Trump camp really not on board with that. But look at what happens if we compare the Always Trump, people who had been with Trump sort of both in 2016 and favor him in 2020. You can see these really big differences between these kind of factions inside the Republican Party, in particular on this idea of building a wall with Mexico. That's a 50-point gap between the kind of Never Trump category and the Always Trump category on the end. One more look here is the negative partisanship numbers that we looked at just a minute ago. These are the same numbers that we looked at a second ago. But here we see, sir, if we look at the Never Trump and the leaning away from Trump folks, neither one of them, if you look at the orange bars, neither one of them are in majority territory, saying that the Democratic Party is so misguided, right, that it poses a threat to the country. But if we look at folks who are either leaning toward Trump now or were always with Trump, you see the kind of negative partisanship really jump, right? So 54% of those leaning toward Trump, and more than 6 in 10, 62% of those in the always Trump camp saying that the Democratic Party poses a fundamental threat to the country. So just much more strongly on this negative partisanship measures. And then this last one I'll do before I want to give you a smattering of issues, kind of current issues before we wrap up. But this last one here is a question we've asked kind of across the last year about some things that we heard actually in some focus groups that because things have gotten so far off track, we need a leader who's willing to break the rules in order to set things right is the end of that question. And here are the number of people who agree among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents. So 55% of them agree, of Republicans and leaners agree with that statement. But in the Never Trump camp, only 35% agree that that's this kind of authoritarian leader is the kind we need. Those who have moved one way or the other are kind of divided on the question. But here's the number for those sort of all in the always Trump category, sort of highly sort of agreeing with this statement at about 2/3 agreeing with this statement that we need a leader who's willing to break the rules if that's what it takes in order to set things right. Okay. So I'm going to wrap here with some selected current issues, some things that are where we're really divided, and I promise I'm going to leave at the end with at least one place where we agree. All right. So most Americans, this question about athletes kneeling at football games, right, has become something of a political football, no pun intended. So here is where all Americans are. It turns out that all Americans, 55%, actually agree that professional athletes should be required to stand during the national anthem at sporting events. Whites and Latinos are here in agreement. But look at African Americans on the issue, right? 3/4 of African Americans disagree with that statement. And not surprisingly, probably, the partisan divides are just huge on this. 86% of Republicans agreeing with this statement, 2/3 of Democrats disagreeing with this statement. So that's kind of where we are with that issue. The media. Do you think most reporters have a personal or political agenda? Are most reporters trying to report the news fairly and accurately? We'll have Joy up here in a minute. Put the spotlight on her. Here's where we are. Most of the country, 53%, says that that reporters have a personal and political agenda. 43% saying they're trying to report the news accurately. It is just, again, a kind of partisan divide on this question. 8 in 10 Republicans saying reporters have a personal and political agenda. 2/3 of Democrats disagreeing, saying that most reporters are trying to report the news accurately. So this kind of partisan lens, even on the media here. On some of Trump, in particular, Trump's signature immigration issues, here we can see. So here's where the country is. And I don't want to pause here to kind of just take this in. So here's 3 policies, temporarily preventing people from some majority Muslim countries entering the U.S., passing a law to prevent refugees from entering the U.S., and building a wall along the U.S. border with Mexico. I do want to point out that for neither one of these policies does support in the general population exceed 40%. right? So that's kind of where the country is as a whole. But I want to put up the partisan divides, and you can see why I think this has become kind of a fight. So there's Republican support, self-identified Republican support for each of these three issues. You know, it's 56% here passing a law to prevent refugees, so less support for that, but kind of very strong support for the kind of Muslim travel ban and building a wall. And independents and Democrats looking kind of much, much different from and this is in some ways what political scientists often call asymmetrical polarization, right? We have kind of one party out in one place and then independents and Republicans more aligned on the other side of an issue, and particularly building a wall. You can just see this massive gap between Republicans and basically everyone else on this question. One thing I don't have a slide up here on that I will say on the immigration front is that we did find 72% support for the basic policies underlying DACA, and that is basically the question we have asked about whether people who are brought to the U.S. as children should be able to stay in the U.S. And get legal status if they go to college or serve in the military. We found 72% support for that, including 6 in 10 Republicans in support for that. So there's bipartisan support for that policy, although there's these divisions here. And I will this one here, there is also fairly widespread agreement on this question of sexual harassment. And the way we ask this question about is basically whether stories about women being sexually harassed and assaulted in the workplace are isolated incidents or are they part of a broader pattern of how women are treated. 7 in 10 Americans say it's part of a broader pattern. There is a gender gap, but it's not overwhelming, and most men are agreeing with women on this question that it's part of a broader pattern. There's also a partisan gap, but again, both parties essentially on the same side of this question. So on this question that's been kind of all over the news pretty much every day, we actually have bipartisan agreement and kind of agreement across the gender. So I will kind of wrap it up with that little moment of agreement, bipartisan and cross-gender agreement, and then we will see where else we want to go with the discussion with the rest of the panel. So thank you.
Well, as always, Robbie, you've gotten us off to a running or even a flying start, and we'll see whether we can keep the momentum up. I'm Bill Galston, a senior fellow here at Brookings and a fully indicted co-conspirator in this effort for a number of years, I think actually since the beginning. And, you know, I am delighted that we've gotten our dream team back together for yet another return engagement. This is the band that never grows old. I'll introduce our two commentators in the order in which they'll give their presentations. To Robbie Jones' right or left, depending on where you're looking, is Henry Olson, who's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a very well-known commentator on American politics, someone who is passionately interested in thinking through the electoral challenges facing the Republican Party and resolving them favorably, consistent with conservative principles, and I would say doing right by ordinary Americans. This perspective was the basis of his book, The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism, which was published in June of this year. And you know, Henry has been an intellectual leader in a series of center-right think tanks going back quite a long way. I could go on, but if you want to know more, it's all in the written materials that you have. And we're equally delighted to have Joy-Ann Reid back with us. As many of you know, she's a leading political analyst for MSNBC, the host of AM Joy, and a noted author as well. She wrote a book entitled Fracture, Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the Racial Divide, published a couple of years ago. Co-editor of a book entitled We Are the Change We Seek, the Speeches of Barack Obama, and also a widely read columnist at the Daily Beast. So in that order, we'll hear from the two commentators, and then I will throw it over to EJ for the first question, and we'll be off. Henry?
That one. There we go. Well, as the only Republican on this panel, I feel that I am in a unique position, and I feel like I'm the official responder to the State of the Union address, which has been provided by President Jones. So, in honor of the 2013 Republican responder to the President Obama's State of the Union address, Marco Rubio, I'd like to start by taking a sip of water.
Henry's better than that.
I'm going to directly address the question, what does it mean to be a Republican under Trump, by trying to create a unifying theme underneath Robbie's data. I think what it means to be a Republican under Trump is to be scared. That what drove appeal for Donald Trump in the primaries and what allowed him to unify a very hesitant party behind him and now turn many of them into loyal fans has been a sense of fear among different groups of Republicans. And that what explains the Never Trump people is actually a different type of fear, one that can be exploited by people of the Democratic Party if they're willing to understand what it is the Never Trump people are afraid of, and how that is both different from and similar to the sort of things that Democrats find so heinous about President Trump. President Trump, as we'll recall, started with a strong appeal to what can only be called some form of economic ethnocentric nationalism, that the focus on immigration and trade and America First had both economic and non-economic appeals to it. The people who resonated most clearly to that at first are not dissimilar from similar types of people we find throughout the world, which is to say people who are less educated, native-born, who are economically stressed or on a downward trajectory, and who also feel themselves socially out of step with a changing country. We find that these are the sort of people that backed UKIP in Britain. These are the sort of people who support Marine Le Pen in France, and so forth throughout the world. These people are afraid of losing their place in a nation's society. And that includes economic stress, which is one reason why Trump always talked about trade early on, even though data have suggested since then that it was not the strong message across the board that he might have thought. Among this group of people, it went hand in hand with opposition to immigration, because what they felt was that through trade policy and through immigration policy, people who run the country were favoring foreigners over citizens, and that was a basic breach of contract. That these people were afraid of losing their economic and cultural place in American life, and they wanted it back. So Donald Trump rockets to the top of the American of the Republican primary, largely on the backs of this sort of fear. He then adds to it security fear, that throughout the rest of the campaign, you were talking about Muslim ban. In fact, the time when Donald Trump really cements his front-runner status, goes from a possible winner to an almost certain winner, was when he proposes the Muslim ban in response to the Paris and San Bernardino attacks. His favorable rating, if you look at the crosstabs, doesn't go up very much between November and January. He's still among Republicans at that time between 55 and 60-something percent. Much lower than what you see now. But his conversion rate of support goes up significantly. He goes from 25% in the polls to 35% in the polls and never looks back. And both data from the voter study group that Robbie and Bill and I serve on, and data from the exit polls show that the one issue that unifies Trump's coalition, as much as they disagree on many other things, is support, whether fervid or partial support, for the Muslim ban. And again, I think that gets into the fear question, is that people who are afraid for their lives and security, whether rationally or not, is something that Democrats and Republicans disagree on. But people who have that fear get added to the Trump coalition after the Muslim ban. And they see that as a symbol that the president is fighting for them. For many people, the Black Lives Matter and the crime discussion that President Trump interjected in the campaign later after the primary was part of that same equation. But after the primary, he had to unify his party. And he again did it on the basis of feeding into the fears that these different groups have. Robbie is the expert here among white Christian America, so I will be waiting to hear him offer modifications to what I'm about to say. But I think the default mindset for the evangelical Christian in the United States is one of fear, that this used to be a country that their social norms, if not their denomination, largely predominated both in law and in public mores. It is one in which their views no longer predominate in law and often outside of their enclaves do not predominate in public mores. And they are afraid. They are not only afraid for the change, they are afraid because they see the progressive left as wanting to stamp them out. And again, whether one thinks that's rational or not, one can see that fear when one talks to them, is that what's, if they're going to, we have the case today about the person who won't bake a cake for a homosexual couple who want to get married. And if we're a religious evangelical, the question is, if they won't even let him do that, what won't they let us do next? And so what Donald Trump basically does is say, I share your fear and I'll give you what you care about, religious liberty and strong people on the courts. For liberty Republicans, they've been afraid for quite some time that the America they believe exists, the America they believe is the best explanation of America, one where the federal government does as little as possible and gets out of the way to let people solve their own problems, is fading from view. Now, I think the data suggested that America left at least 85 years ago, but for about 15% to 20% of the Republican Party, that's still something that they hold dear to, and it's something that you see animated throughout Republican Party discussions. And I think the rapid move towards expanding government under Barack Obama, even if imperfectly obtained and even if imperfectly desired from the perspective of progressives to these people, stoked the fear that that America will never come back. And so Donald Trump pledges to these people deregulation and big tax cuts so that their fear gets addressed too. And Donald Trump wins the presidency by creating this coalition that basically feeds on fear. There are people in the coalition who are afraid of the changing racial and cultural aspects of America. And increasingly, in his tweets in the presidency, the president plays into that. I think the voter study group data show that this is actually a very small part of his coalition, but it's one that seems to have a very large effect in his consciousness based on how he responds to in the silence and the privacy of his own room. But that explains in some part what it means to be an American or Republican in this time. And it shows up in Robbie's figures that the more partisan you are, the more likely you are to be loyally behind Trump, the more likely you are to think that the Democratic Party is posing a threat for America. And consequently, when you feel that, then virtually any means are necessary to combat that threat. And that supports what the data that Robbie shows that says that the strongest partisans are the people most likely to say break the rules. This showed up in the famous essay, The Flight 93 Election, which was authored pseudonymously by a man now in the White House, Michael Anton, who basically posited that, which is say that the Democratic Party, if they take control of the Flight 93 airplane, will crash America into the ground, and consequently, anything is required, even supporting this man. That sort of mentality is I thought at the time was like a pre-Spanish Civil War mentality, and it gives rise to a Civil War mentality, which is that we're in a war and we must win. So if you understand that, you understand why the president can retain those support, because there's nothing that the Democratic Party is doing that makes those fears go away. So then what do we say about the Never Trump people? What are they afraid of? Well, what Never Trump people tend to be afraid of is a party that used to be theirs that isn't theirs anymore. They don't share those fears, most of them. We saw that in Robbie's data. They look and they say, I'd prefer Hillary Clinton not to be president. But, you know, we got through things before. We'll get through things again. You know, we'll have our chance in power. America is still good. They look and they see a party that no longer represents their values, a party that no longer has a place for them, in which they seem to be outcast. And then the question is, how do they fit into a modern two-party political system? And the fact is, they don't. They don't fit into a two-party political system where the alternative has no room for them on any of the things that they do care about. And they don't fit into a Republican Party that also has no room for them. And you saw this, I think, in what happened in the election, which is that Donald Trump won because he decisively won among the 18% of Americans who didn't like either candidate. If you look at the GW Battleground poll, that was the only major poll that was asking the same questions and provided crosstab data before the exit polls. And they showed that same 18% in September of 2016 and October of 2016, they were largely or disproportionately Republican or Republican-leaning college-educated men, and they broke very late to the president. They did not want to support him, but they ended up choosing the devil that they felt policy comfortable with over the devil that they felt policy uncomfortable with. So what I leave the challenge for a Democratic Party that looks to be riding resistance to a very good midterm, if not a wave, then not a tsunami, then a wave, which is to say, do you want to be a party that takes advantage of this to form a new coalition? Or do you want to commit the errors that the Republicans did in misreading the fervor of their base in the 2010 election for the mood of the country? And I think that's the challenge that progressives and Democrats face going forward, is how to accommodate and soothe some of the fears of the people who they could win over, and how to make animosity among the people they will defeat much less, to try and make our country a safer and more harmonious place.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, William and Robbie, for the amazing data. And, of course, my buddy EJ Dionne. Thank you all for coming. I, surprisingly enough, will just concur with everything that Henry Olsen just said. Because I think he's absolutely right. And I think it's important that he mentioned UKIP and the international community. I feel that you can't really understand Donald Trump in a vacuum of just looking at American politics. Just this weekend on my TV show, we did a story that had to do with the slave trade in Libya. And I'm going somewhere with this. It's relevant. It turns out that part of what's happening and the reason you have sub-Saharan African, mostly men, but men and women being sold in a slave market in Libya is because these are people who are trying to flee to Europe. They're economic refugees who are in large part ending up in places like Italy and are being soundly rejected by the Italian public, who are really freaked out by this massive wave of immigration, much as other parts of Europe are really responding to a massive wave of immigration from North Africa and from places like Syria that has driven far-right politics in Europe and led to the growth of parties like UKIP, of people like Marine Le Pen, of these same movements really throughout Western Europe, where people see an influx of immigrants who to them are not European, who are not French in the sense that French had a meaning in their view, who are not British in the sense that being British had a meaning in their view that was in part cultural, but in part racial, quite frankly. And that seeing these waves of immigrants over time who don't assimilate into the country, in a lot of cases, because culturally it's a lot harder to assimilate in Europe than it is in the United States. We're sort of a country that builds in the idea that you can become American in one generation, like I did. But in Europe, it's not always the case. You can be two and three generations in and still be seen as Moroccan or Pakistani. And so as you've seen these more recent waves of immigration that have resulted from either economic want on the African continent or war in places like Yemen and Syria, you've had the growth of really what are many Donald Trumps and many movements that are exactly like Trumpism. And then if you look at the data, look exactly like Trumpism. So I think Henry is absolutely right that what you have is you have a part of the country that is nostalgic for a past where it had cultural hegemony and economic hegemony, but where the cultural hegemony is the thing that they feel they're losing most. And I'll point you to some of Robbie's data that I found really interesting was on the coming tax cut, which probably will pass, and which has become the subject of a lot of our coverage because of how unpopular it is with almost everyone, including with a lot of Republicans. And in Robbie's data, nearly 6 in 10 people, the majority of people polled here, nearly half, believe that the tax policy, when ascribed to Donald Trump, will be of almost no benefit to them at all. And we found not just in Robbie's poll, but in other polling, that Republicans agree that they probably won't get much out of it. The difference is that Democrats really care about that, independents really care about that, and Republicans by and large don't. And so economics and saying that economic want is the driver of Trumpism, I think, misses the point. You also have growing agreement across parties, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, about health care. When we, in our business, talk with people who are in places like Kentucky or places like North Carolina, there's as much anxiety about losing their health care, including losing Medicaid, as there is among Democrats. There's an agreement, a growing agreement, and a growing disinclination to oppose the idea of federally driven health care, even among Republicans. Robbie's data has the opposition to the federal government being involved in providing health care going down from 75% in 2013 to 66% among Republicans. So even Republicans are coming around to this idea that the federal government should be doing something to help people get health care. The difference is, when the policy is attached to the Republican Party and Donald Trump, they don't care. I recently spoke with a longtime Republican in Alabama as part of a story I was doing for the Daily Beast, which talked about black versus white attitudes in the election and the fact that African Americans in Alabama are feeling that they're getting the disproportionate sort of attention and potential blame from the media for what will probably be a more victory. And they're saying, well, you really need to look at the other party, because they are almost universally Republican in terms of white Alabamians. And so it's really on them if they're going to reject Roy Moore, was the message I was getting from black politicos in Alabama. So I spoke with one of these sort of white political poobahs who said, look, and this was somebody who reluctantly voted for Roy Moore in the primary because they saw Luther Strange as being corrupt and part of the whole corrupt machine of Alabama politics that, in case you don't know, had gone down in sex scandals and money scandals and all sorts of stuff. And Luther Strange was associated with it. And this person had a lot of justification for saying Moore was the lesser of two evils. But it was interesting what this person said to me about, and they're a longtime political player in Alabama, which was that the support for Roy Moore, and they were very front-loaded about saying it had nothing to do with race, it had nothing to do with bigotry, but that it had to do with Alabama Republican voters, who are the majority, worrying that not having Roy Moore there would mean that their values didn't carry in Washington, and that the most important things to them were immigration. And it was mentioned over and over again that people in Alabama, which is not a state that shares a border with Mexico, that people in Alabama were very concerned that we are not controlling the border, and that the border must be controlled and that immigration must be curtailed. And I asked this person whether or not there was a large problem with unlawful immigration in Alabama, and they could not tell me there was. I asked them whether they had had personal contact or knew of people who had negative contact with immigrants. They could not. They lived in a community that was almost entirely white. They really encountered no one other than white people and black people. But they still had a very strong feeling about immigration being the top problem in the country. The second thing that this person mentioned was it was religion, and was the fact that in their view, there needed to be judges who would respect religious liberty, which in their view meant that Christians would have certain rights protected by the federal government. And there are things that Donald Trump, who doesn't seem to be a very religious man, has done that has earned him the absolute fealty of Republicans. I had another Republican text me this morning, who's somebody I've had on the show, and who's a very religious Republican, who's an abortion voter. It's what their main thing is. Gleefully telling me that Donald Trump is going to move the American embassy to Jerusalem, which of course would probably touch off a third intifada and an absolute outbreak of violence in the Middle East. But to this person, this was the best news ever. And it was a sign of Trump keeping his promises to his voters and to Christians. And so Christians see Donald Trump as sort of a figure that, while he may be personally heretical, was carrying the gospel into public policy, because he's putting judges in who will protect Christian cake bakers, who will, in this tax bill, sign a piece of legislation that will drop the federal prohibition against churches directly getting involved in politics. Whose tax policies will favor people who educate their children in home schools and in private schools, and disproportionately disfavor public schools, which a lot of these Republican voters also oppose, because they think they're inculcating children with liberal and almost communistic values. And in the South, you had after the desegregation, successful desegregation of public schools, what one of the ramifications of that is in the South, you had a lot of white parents just pull their kids out of public school. And a lot of these parents send their kids to private school or homeschool them, so they don't care about public schools necessarily. And they sort of like the idea of disadvantaging them. And so those were the most important issues to him. So it was religion. It was a Muslim ban, which this person, back to my first Republican, my Alabama Republican, also said it's very important that that the country curtail the migration and influx of potentially dangerous Muslims into the country. They thought that was very important. The one thing that neither of these two Republicans ever mentioned to me was economics or taxes, quite frankly, or deficits or anything like that. There was no mention of economic want, and neither of these two people are poor. Moving on to my students, I teach a class in race, gender, and media for Syracuse University, and I had my class do an exercise where I had them go out and interview a Trump voter, which for a lot of them was difficult for them to find among their colleagues, their friends, right, because they're college students. So some interviewed their parents or relatives, some interviewed people they knew. I had to supply two people with a Trump voter to interview because they couldn't find any. But what was remarkable about these interviews, which I asked Robbie permission to get, just let him see, because they're really amazing. They kind of read like the narrative of the data that you just saw. The number one unifying issue among the individual people who ranged in age, who did not range in race, they were all white, they were mostly male. The number one issue among these Trump voters was immigration. Far more than anything else, immigration was mentioned as a negative impact on the country, and it's mostly down to illegal immigration from Mexico, and that it must be curtailed, and that there must be a wall. That was the number one issue. The Muslim ban did come up. One thing that barely ever came up was economics, was economic want or economic anxiety. I have, in just reporting on the president and on his supporters now for over a year, very rarely come across economic anxiety, except among Democrats who favored Donald Trump. When you talk to Republicans who favor Donald Trump, it is mostly down to culture. It is mostly down to immigration. And I think it's uncomfortable for my profession to confront it, but it's a lot down to race. It's a lot down to a discomfort with a country that is changing ethnically and that, in their view, is washing a wave of what they see as not real Americans over the country's cultural life and putting them in the margins. And they don't want to be in the margins. And this is a fight. It's a war. And I'll end by saying that in a lot of ways, what's interesting about Donald Trump is that he's sort of almost sort of a flip side kind of bizarro world Obama. And what I mean by that is that for a lot of hardcore Obama voters, Obama was the point. It wasn't specifically that he would do some specific economic thing. This is the reason that you never really saw much of a drop in enthusiasm for reelecting him, particularly among African Americans, because in a lot of ways, he was the point. His physical persona was the point. It was the symbolism of having somebody who is not white, somebody who has international roots in his family, somebody who represented a changing America. He, in and of himself, in his biography, represented new America. And having that symbolism, that family, those children, that wife, those people in the White House was in a lot of ways the point. It was that was the catharsis for a lot of Obama voters. It was seeing ourselves in the mirror and seeing Obama and his family reflected back. For a lot of Trump voters, Trump is the point. It isn't his policies. It's not what he's going to do even for them. If you tell them that the tax cuts are going to hurt them and they're going to pay for tax cuts for the rich, we haven't seen much evidence that they care. If you tell them that Donald Trump's policies are going to make America less popular around the world or less effective around the world, that is not an argument that works with them. They really don't care. Just having that man who is white and very ethno-nationalist in his whiteness, and who is, in a sense, as I think Ta-Nehisi Coates has called him, the first white president, very proactive about putting forward his gender and racial identity and saying, I represent this and I will attack the people who, in your view, are detriments to it. I'll attack that black football player. I'll attack Jemele Hill from the ESPN. I'll attack black women. I'll attack people of color. I'll attack the people that annoy you too. And that's the point. And so I think for Democrats who are really kind of obsessed with this idea of converting Trump voters over, I'm not sure that can be done, because I think that for a lot of people, Trump is their Obama, you know, and he has a cultural power over at least a third of the country that I don't think anything can break. And I was not surprised by Robbie's data that 4 in 10 Republicans say there's literally nothing he can do to not earn their support. And I 100% believe that.
Well, after hearing these three presentations, I bet everybody shares my feeling. I wish we had all day to talk about this, but we don't. We have 34 minutes, pretty much evenly divided between this group up here and this group down there. So, EJ, first question.
Okay, I'm going to combine two questions just so we can move forward. And the first question I'm going to pose differently to Henry and Joy, although it's based on the same data. To Henry, I think these numbers help explain why Democrats had such a good day in the off-year elections. These are very dangerous numbers for Republicans. Only 15% in Robbie's numbers are strong Trump supporters. Basically, no matter what he does, we'll stick with him. And among Republicans, only 37% are in that category, which is quite remarkable and a potential problem. On the other side, you see enormous mobilization and much stronger feelings. There are 15% strong Trump supporters, 34% who disapprove and say nothing will change their minds. That's double. That's more than double. And I note there's a chart in the report that Robbie didn't put up that, 2 years into Obama's presidency, this was after the bad midterms, after all the Tea Party attacks, 50% were still enthusiastic about him. Only 320 days into Trump's presidency, if Trump were here, as my friend Norm Ornstein likes to say, 320 days longer than any other president in our history. But after only 320 days, he's at 48%. That's a pretty quick decline. So the question to Henry is, I won't combine the two questions. I'll just throw this one out there first, and I'll hold on the other one. How do Republicans come back from this? Because the Trump base that we talk about so much, by this reckoning, is actually quite small relative to the current base that opposes him. And to Joy, I want to flip that around, because to me, these numbers show that there are a substantial number of Trump voters or supporters who can be converted. I agree with you that among those 15% in the country and those 37% of Republicans, nothing in particular will change their minds. But this is a substantial drop off from where Trump stood on Election Day 2016. So I want to sort of challenge you on the there are no converts to be had on the one hand, and I want to sort of ask Henry, what in the heck are the Republicans going to do with these kind of numbers?
So what are the Republicans going to do? They're going to ignore them. I think that's what the tax bill basically shows, is that they remain wedded to old dogma, and they're going to argue that old dogma is going to get them out of this. I think they're wrong. But I think what we should do, though, is break down the electorate, which is that if we take a look at, you know, Virginia, which is where a lot of attention was paid because of the massive gains in the House of Delegates races. I wrote about this in City Journal magazine, but if you look both at the exit polls and you look at the places where they gained, it mirrored the 2016 presidential race very, very closely. The reason they won so many seats in the delegates race is because Republicans held a lot of places that Hillary Clinton had won with a majority of the vote. In 2017, the people who voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016 voted for Democrats for the House of Delegates. So what that suggests is that the phenomena that saved the House for the Republicans in 2016, the Romney voter who voted for Clinton but split their ticket, is not splitting their ticket anymore. These people are disproportionately educated whites in major metropolitan areas. The Republicans hold the House by 24 seats. There are 23 seats that Clinton carried. All they have to do is hold on to that, and they're going to be within an eyelash of winning the House. But the flip side is the Obama-Trump voter. If you look at the exit polls, most of those people voted for Ed Gillespie. They just didn't come out as much. If that's what...
And that's what I think, that's the problem I'm alluding to.
Right. And now, if that's what happens in the fall, then what will happen is that some of those seats that are based on Obama-Trump voters will fall away from Republicans as well, not because Democrats have converted them, but because their man isn't on the ballot and they're not enthusiastic about it. But the Republican base, whether they like Trump or dislike Trump, are going to stick with him absent something major that happens that causes any sane person to reconsider over the next year, you know, which is to say that that transcends genuine policy differences between the parties. That has not happened yet. So I would expect it's going to be a good year, but not a great year for Republicans. But Republicans so far show no inclination of reacting to this and are basically doubling down on the idea that economic growth will win back the Romney-Clinton voter and cultural issues will continue to excite the Obama-Trump voter. And I think there's little evidence for that.
Right. And I, again, agree with Henry. I don't know what's happening to me. I mean, maybe I don't know what's going on. But yeah,
you're bringing students and Trump voters together.
I'm bringing them together. Yeah. No, I'll tell you what my Republican strategist friends say about this. And I do have Republican strategist friends, believe it or not. What they're saying is that, again, Trump is the upside down Obama. Right. Do you guys watch Stranger Things? He's in the upside down, but he's Obama in the upside down. And the Obama voter that was brought to politics by Obama in 2008 was an Obama-only voter in the main. They weren't a Democratic voter, meaning that they weren't to be counted on 2 years later when Obama wasn't on the ballot, but they came roaring back when he was again. That drop-off voter that caused Michigan to have 66% turnout or something, 64% turnout in 08, and then 44, and then in 10, and then 62, and then in 2012, and then back down in the 40s. That's what my Republican strategist friends are worried about, that the Trump voter, who was the most marginal kind of voter, they're not a regular voter necessarily, but they were really excited by the economic populist message, the anti-immigrant message, the wall, all of that stuff. They're there for Trump. And by and large, that same voter is actually angry at the Republican Party because they don't think that they're supportive enough of Trump. They don't think I've actually heard very strong Roy Moore supporters say that the enemy is Mitch McConnell. They speak more angrily about Mitch McConnell than they do about Democrats. And sometimes they don't even talk about Democrats. They just talk about how weaselly the Republican Party has been and that they're not helping Trump fulfill his agenda. So what my Republican strat friends are concerned about is that what you'll have is not conversion, because I think voting behavior typically is that people now vote tribe, that your party is your tribe. Hillary was sui generis in that some never Trump Republicans thought Trump was so dangerous that they reluctantly cast a vote for Hillary Clinton. I don't think they're people who generally bounce back and forward and probably had never not voted for another Democrat ever. But in the case of these voters who voted for Donald Trump and are Republicans, it's much more likely that they just stay home and that they just don't show up. And so what Republicans are concerned about is that they have a drop off in turnout while Democrats have a surge in interest and turnout, and that if they lose the midterms and they lose the House, that is what will lose it. It won't be converts. It will be people who stay home on their side and many more people in the resistance who vote.
Bill, do you want to take it from there?
Oh, gosh. I wish
you... I'll ask my other question,
No.
I thought that would persuade you.
Yeah. When I said, oh, gosh, it wasn't because I was at a loss for questions. I know I'm only going to get one shot, and I'm trying to figure out what that shot is. But let me put it this way. Joy made, I think, a powerful case, a case with which I happen to agree, about the primacy of the immigration issue as a driver not only of contemporary American politics, but of populist movements throughout the Democratic West. Query to Henry and Robbie. Based on your reading of the data, do you agree with that proposition? And if so, what are the implications?
So immigration, I think,
I'm on. Okay.
A really interesting thing. What I want to say is I agree with Henry about, you know, where he started, that
one of the operative things going on, particularly on the Republican side of politics, is fear. Like that, I think, is just we have to take that in. It's fear, and our data, even some of the voter study group data, indicates that it's more cultural fear than it is economic fear. They're both in the mix, absolutely, but the cultural fear, particularly among white working class Americans, tends to trump, no pun intended, the economic fear. But what's interesting is that it's the symbolic issues that are animating more than the practical policy issues on immigration. So it's like actually kind of tricky. So if you talk about the wall, right, that sort of symbol, I think this idea that symbols are when you're at war, and I think that's right, when you're at war, symbols begin to matter in ways they didn't matter before, right? So Confederate monuments, flags, these kinds of things, they come into the foreground. And I think the wall is one of those things, right? It's something that I think most people don't really think is actually going to get built. But the idea of it, I think, is quite important to some people, and particularly to Republicans. Like we're showing 73% of Republicans favor building a wall versus only 12% of Democrats, right? So that's where we are on the wall issue. But if you ask about policies, if you ask about DACA, if you ask about even a path to citizenship, which hasn't been a real legislative option in years, even there you get 6 in 10 Americans and half of Republicans, even on a path to citizenship among rank-and-file Republicans, supporting that policy, which politically speaking has not been viable, you know, like I said, for several years now. So when you turn from symbols to policy, there's less polarization. But the symbols and the fear of it, I think, has overrun the policies, really, and the policies just get run under by the fears. So if you get people out of that mindset and you just ask them about what should we do with 11 million undocumented immigrants in the country today, Americans are kind of pragmatic about that. But if you talk about the wall, sort of, I think pragmatics and kind of rationality kind of goes out the window. So I think that's kind of where we are with the way that immigration is playing in our politics. And as long as it's being sort of stoked, I think, pulling together kind of the pragmatic, you know, with the political is going to be a really difficult thing to do.
I write a lot about international populism for an English website called Unheard, U-N-H-E-R-D. So you can see, yeah, I got my plug in. so, I do it every week, you can take a look ongoing. And my thoughts, last week's column was about Australia's blue-collar populist party, One Nation. What's interesting to me is two things, a couple of things. One, it's always the same sort of people around the world who get animated by this. Two, they're always in economically downscale places. They tend to be in the left behind places, like even in Germany, where AfD tended to do best, are in East Germany, which still has never recovered from the communist domination, or in the West, really run down parts of industrial Ruhrbelt, where you can find these areas, which is the German version of Youngstown. So I think things go hand in hand. That's what Rui Teixeira at the Center for American Progress found when he looked at this, is that economic anxiety helps enable cultural anxiety. So it's kind of like taking one strand from the DNA's double helix and isolating it. Take a look at Germany, which was almost unique among Europe for not having one of these parties, even though they had 2 million Turks who have been living there for 50 years. You know, what sets it off? What sets it off is the decision to admit up to 2 million refugees in one time, which would be as if 8 million people in America came across the Canadian border. And I think if 8 million Syrians were coming across the Canadian border in one calendar year, that would have set off an America. That's basically what happened in Germany. But it took that rather than anything else, which suggests that there's something rational as well as something irrational going on. And then the third thing I'd want to say is, what do you do about it? That the response, one of the things that I chronicle throughout the world is that whether you are on the left or on the right, if you're educated and well off, you tend to look at these reactions as being hopelessly naive, out of touch, racist, irrational, and consequently worthy of being ignored. And I've had these discussions with German parliamentarians, with Swedish business people. Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, who's of the Liberal Party, which is the conservative party there. And he thinks that One Nation's people are racist. And so the question is, how do you negotiate a peace with, you know, if that's the response, you shouldn't expect them to give up their arms. And so if the question is, how do you deal with this? You have to deal with it in some way, as many leaders are beginning to deal with, which is trying to peel away legitimate grievance from illegitimate grievance and consequently letting the air out of the populist balloon. That if the answer is basically to build a wall around populism, what you simply do is build up the tension, build up the partisanship, and then if you go through some sort of economic decline that makes people even more people despairing, you raise the possibility of a much more dangerous counterreaction than if you slowly work peel away the legitimate from the illegitimate and let the air out of the populist balloon.
And can I just add one quick thing that I think the problem, the challenge in the analysis, not the problem, the challenge in the analysis is that no one has successfully answered the question why the groups who are the most subject to economic want, right? People who have always lived in communities that were going nowhere. And I'm talking about Black and Hispanic people. If you look at Black communities in Mississippi that have essentially been poor since the end of slavery, why have they not been tempted by populism? Why are more economically downscale Black and brown people not tempted by this? That's the reason that you have to bring race into the analysis, because there's clearly nothing biologically different about all of these different people. They're all people, they're all earthlings, and they're all downscale economically, but their reactions to being downscale, I mean, for God's sakes, Black people have been downscale for 420 something years in this country, right? Or since the arrival in Jamestown. So why aren't, I mean, and there were brief moments of temptation to a more radical reaction. You know, you can look at the rise of the Black Panthers, where they were very attractive in part because they were providing breakfast to kids. But those, other than those sort of sporadic retreats toward radicalism, I think we do have to start doing a deeper analysis of what's going on in this country as regards to its legacy on race, to try to understand why this particular group is more subject to this kind of ethno-nationalistic populism than everyone else, and why that is true in the West. There is something else to it.
One thing I would just want to throw out is, I think if you want to do that, you have to also look at the Democrats. You know, which is to say that, you know, it, most people, I think, would say that Bernie Sanders offered some form of democratic populism. But yet African Americans in the Mississippi Delta rejected him 9-1. So what is, but yet you can't say that race is part of that analysis, because nobody's going to stand up. Maybe I'm wrong about this as a, in my Republican bubble, but, you know, I don't think most people would stand up and say that Bernie Sanders appealed to race or is a racist. So if they're rejecting left-wing populism in the chance where they are a dominant feature and they're not, then the question becomes something a little bit different, I think. And, you know, in other places you don't have the history of racism, but yet you still see similar behaviors, which is why I'm less likely to ascribe what's happening in blue-collar communities solely to race, because you see in other places that don't have the legacy of slavery or racism to the degree that America did. But I think African-American voters, with respect to what how they respond to economic deprivation, is a very different thing, and I can't say that I understand it, but it's clear that both left and right, they're not open to the same sort of populist appeals in the United States, and the question would be why.
So there's one quick comment. I know we want to get to the floor, but just very quickly, so Joy, you and I have talked about this a little bit, both in private and on the air, but you know, when I was working on the book that ended up, you know, calling it The End of White Christian America, one of the reasons why I chose the term is because I think that's actually part of, it's not the whole answer, but I think it is part of the key, right? That for many, even downscale whites, the link to being part of the dominant race and the dominant religion played a huge role in their self-perception. And what Henry was saying earlier, I think it's less about being just economically deprived than it is about loss of status and loss of, you know, that's a nice way of saying loss of dominance, right? And it really is about moving from a place of cultural dominance to a place where you're no longer the dominant culture, neither in terms of race or religion, and feeling the country shifting in ways. I mean, I think the Supreme Court case today is about the shift, right, of the Master case, that it's about this kind of cultural shift. I mean, just, you know, 10 years ago, 6 in 10 Americans opposed same-sex marriage, right? Today, more than 6 in 10 Americans support same-sex marriage. It's a huge shift in a short amount of time. And I think it's this perceived demographic shift, cultural shift, and religious shift in the country where kind of move from dominance to not a place of dominance, to a place of vulnerability in many ways. That, I think, is the difference for many white, particularly Protestant Americans today.
And I think don't underestimate how much Barack Obama radicalized a lot of people who had the propensity to feel this way. And don't underestimate how much the misperception that he is Muslim, combined with the fact that he is black, fed that radicalization. Because that, in a nutshell, is what Robbie just said. The perception that over the will of the majority of white Americans, who only gave Barack Obama about 4 in 10, so only about 4 in 10 voted for him, and that against the wishes of the majority of white America, this black person who they perceived as a Muslim gets elected and reelected by the sheer will of non-white America in their perception. Don't underestimate that. And Donald Trump's presidency is animated, you know, by a vehement rejection of Obama's existence on this planet and a desire to erase it retroactively, to go back and scrub it out. And that is actually a very powerful message, irrespective of what he offers economically.
I want to say something quickly. What we're dealing with here is a real conundrum that I think we've been grappling with for the last several years. On the one hand, there is clearly racism out there that is substantial that has to be dealt with. Second, there is the sense of cultural displacement and the fears that Henry described that are not necessarily racial or racist, although they sometimes are linked. But all of this has happened in an economic context. As Henry pointed out, a lot of the communities where this happens are communities that have been left out of economic growth. And one, I rather doubt that we would be having exactly this conversation if lower middle class, working class voters had had 10 years of 4% growth in their incomes, and that we got to kind of keep these two things or three things in mind at the same time. And that's a real challenge. Joy mentioned Earthlings. Imagine what the political reaction would be if Martians were pouring across our borders. But thank you for that, reminding us we are all one.
Yeah. Depends on Martians' voting propensities, I suspect. But that's our next survey. Absolutely. Okay. I believe in fairness. I believe in fairness to audiences. I believe in geographical fairness. So I'm going to start not in the front of the room, but with this gentleman right here. And there are roving microphones. When the microphone arrives, please identify yourself and, in deference to everyone else, ask a question briefly.
Hi, I'm Richard Skinner. I teach at Johns Hopkins. Henry and I got into a discussion on Twitter a few days ago in which I said, if you voted for Trump thinking that he was going to be Ross Perot rather than Pat Buchanan, which is not the real Ross Perot, but people's idea of Ross Perot, is this non-ideological, get-it-done businessman as opposed to a culture warrior like Pat Buchanan, you really haven't gotten a whole lot. And I'm connecting this to questions about divisions among white working-class voters. Is there any data out there, not just on divisions on gender, but divisions between religious and secular white working-class voters? There were signs that Trump did unusually well with fairly secular white working class voters, and also those voters who are strongly motivated by issues like immigration and race and those who are not.
I have not parsed data to that level, but I think Robbie would be able to come up with similar crosstabs. I know the group that I'm on, the voter study group, would have the data that would allow us to do that, but I haven't parsed the subgroups in that way. I mean, we know from the primary vote that the more secular you were, the more likely you were to tend to vote for President Trump in the Republican primary. Some of that is because the religiously observant were being attracted to Cruz. Some of that was because of an attraction towards Trump in the other direction. But I have not broken down the data, but those are all excellent questions to take a look at.
I commend a piece by Guy Molyneux in the American Prospect a few months ago called Mapping the White Working Class. I was going to look it up, but I didn't have time. As I recall, he finds that about 50% of white non-college voters are reliably conservative, vote Republican, about 15% are liberal and vote Democratic, and that there's about a 35% swing group within this category. And he has a lot of interesting things to say about what makes them swing. I think it's an important piece because we shouldn't treat any group as monolithic, and that includes the white working class. And I think he shows some interesting nuances in that piece.
You know, one thing is the white working class heavily overlaps in this country with evangelical Protestantism. And I think what Trump did was appeal to the non-evangelical Protestant white working class in a way that, and if you take a look, his numbers in the South, where white evangelical Protestants are primarily working class, went up, but not by a huge amount. Where they go up a huge amount is where you find Catholics and non-evangelical Lutherans and Methodists and secular people in the Midwest. That's where it goes up a lot. So whether he's holding them or not is another question, but that goes to the importance of EJ of breaking a group down because the white working class is far from monolithic.
A woman in the second row. Microphone, please. Do we have just one microphone? Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. I'm Peggy Orchowski. I'm the congressional correspondent for the Hispanic Outlook magazine. And I cover a lot about immigration and higher ed. And by the way, Latinos and I think a lot of blacks too pull much higher in their belief in the American dream than a lot of whites do. I think that's one reason they haven't become part of the populace, as you call it, movement. But I think this, obsession with racism and ID politics of the Democrats are missing something that's right out there with Trump, and I'm wondering why you guys haven't talked about it, and that's the threat of globalization, the whole idea of America first. I think immigration's a lot. It's not anti-immigrant or anti-immigrants. It's about national borders, about law enforcement. Law and order is still a big thing for Republicans, the daddy party, you know, not the mommy party. And you don't, and there's an impression that Democrats don't support law enforcement, and particularly when it comes to immigration. And I think that should be addressed.
If I could put a question mark on that, anybody is free to answer.
Very quickly, we have data from the voter study group survey that we did that we'll be releasing soon that suggests that attitudes among Republicans, if you ask whether illegal immigration is a drain, you know, very heavily supportive of that. When you ask if legal immigration is a drain, much more positive, that the Republican voters themselves distinguish between illegal and legal, and the rational explanation for that would have to do something with the value one attaches on enforcement of the law.
But I would point out that if you look at Donald Trump, who presented himself as sort of an anti-globalist populist candidate, and then contrast him with Mitt Romney, who I think anybody would agree is probably more of a globalist sort of Republican, they both got the exact same percentage of the white vote, 59% for Romney, 58% for Trump. There was almost no difference in their electorates. So in a sense, I don't necessarily think that it's just that simple. And so the globalization issue is definitely a talking point among the alt-right. If you go to that extreme part of the right, they are fixated on globalization, which for them, unfortunately, is also something about Jewish people as a sense, right? There's the globalization as a sort of slur that's used on the very, very, very far fringe. And this sort of theme of globalization definitely shows up in the alt-right. But I think among just rank-and-file regular Republicans, I've never had one say it to me. People say they're very much, it's much simpler. It's immigration. It's the country's going to hell. It's Obama ruined the country. It's just much more simple. I think the globalization thing is much more a fringe issue, at least. I don't think rank-and-file voters necessarily think about it. Robbie, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I haven't had a Trump voter say globalization to me.
Yep. Well, we did ask about free trade, so we didn't have a chance to put it up here, but we did ask a question about kind of economic protectionism and free trade versus restrictions, and it turns out that the Never Trump category, 2-1, is the promote free trade group, and always Trump is basically divided between restrictions and free trade. But there's a 20-point gap between the never Trump folks and the always Trump folks on the issue of free trade.
Yeah, I think there's a lot. I think what's fascinating about this survey is that Republicans, partly because of the Trump effect, have moved toward a more hostile attitude toward free trade than they used to have. And I think trade is, I doubt many voters would use the term globalization, but I think trade is right there as a marker for this view that's strong out there among these voters.
One thing I just want to say is that it's true that they got nearly identical shares for the white vote, but the types of whites were very different. That Romney does much better among Trump than among college-educated whites, and you can see that both in the exit polls and in the voting returns, and does much, much better than Romney among blue-collar whites. So what he basically did was shifted the share of the white vote to an electoral college-efficient winning formula, whereas Romney was winning whites in places that didn't matter, and Trump was winning whites in places that did.
Right. But of course, they got just about identical shares of the popular vote. Okay, I'm going to take two more questions, put them together, stated briefly, answered crisply, and we're out of here. So, woman in the front row and the gentleman with the orange tie.
I identify with being from Wisconsin, even though I'm here. And in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, there was really only a difference of about 100,000 votes that carried those three states that won it for Trump. He worked them on the trade issue, on the you're losing your jobs. And my question to you all is, if Trump doesn't deliver on trade, what is your perception of their likelihood to vote in 2018?
You know, I'll tell you that I've said this before, that I think the ad, the most powerful ad in the election, it wasn't made by either of the candidates, but it was for Donald Trump. It was an ad called Man of Steel. And I remember seeing it when we went to Ohio to do a focus group of steel workers in sort of the Cleveland area. And this ad, it showed all these blighted factories all closed and chained up. It was black and white and grim. And then it turned color and it said, we can bring them back. We can reopen these factories. American hands will rebuild this country. American steel will provide the grist for the return of America. It was a powerful ad with a Hollywood sort of voicing it. I think it might have been James Woods. But it was a really powerful ad. And it didn't say Trump. It never said Trump. But at the end, the final line is, we can make America great again. And the Democrats never answered that ad. And I remember saying on TV shows, when are they going to answer the Man of Steel ad? Because I saw that ad played on a loop throughout Ohio. If you went to Pennsylvania, where our next focus group was, that ad was running. And they were really getting at not just Republican voters, but Democrats. Our focus group that we did in Ohio featured six men, one Hispanic, five white, all displaced steel workers, none of whom liked Hillary Clinton at all, who thought they liked her husband, but they felt that she didn't care about steel workers. And they were at least open to Trump. And these were all Democrats. Some of them were active union guys, so their unions were supporting Hillary Clinton. And we found incredible support among these six Democrats for Donald Trump based on that idea that he believed in American steel, even though his own buildings didn't use American steel, they used Chinese steel. But they didn't know that, and Democrats never pointed that out. So I think one of the big mistakes that Democrats have made is not pointing that out and letting go their own voters who just want America to come back in the sense of being an industrial leader. And I think, and I'll be very quick in saying that, I think the big unsolved problem of really global Western politics is, what do you do with the people whose skill set is no longer needed, quote unquote, in the marketplace? It's no longer a growth industry to be a steel worker or to be a miner, but this is what you're trained to do, and your identity is bound up in this is what you do, this is who you are, this is who your son wants to be because he looks up to you. And the West has not solved this problem, because I think elites have made the mistake of seeing these people as sort of throwbacks and of ignoring the idea that they really have no identity without the thing that they do. And what do you do with those? What do we do with a generation of people who don't have a college degree, are not techies, they can't go work in Silicon Valley? that's going to have to get solved, because you're only going to get more populism, because people will turn to the answer that feels viscerally satisfying, which is, well, the immigrants are doing it to me. They're doing it to me. The black people are doing it to me. The welfare cheats are doing it to me. They're going to that answer for a reason, because I think our countries, our societies have not provided an answer.
Well, I've done my best, but I've failed. We've reached the witching hour, and at least one of our panelists has travel plans and a hard stop. So please join me in thanking this extraordinary group of people.